kids may not be small adults, but many pediatricians are. Ladies and gentlemen, the not-so-short Drs. Eileen Claudius and Saul Behar with some pediatric pearls.
This was a 5-month-old female, came in with a respiratory distress for a day.
James Salway, assistant professor at Stony Brook University.
Mom said that she had decreased wet diapers as well as decreased PO intake for the last 2 weeks. Mom also said that starting today, she noticed that she had some purple lips, had increased work of breathing, and also had fever for the last 2 days. Mom had brought her in yesterday, was told it's just a virus, and was sent home at that point. Mom said that she'd been seen by her primary care doctor about 2 weeks ago for the same kind of symptoms. Primary care doctor gave her about a 5-day course of azithromycin, because that's what you do.
That's the standard treatment for viruses, right?
Oh yeah.
Almost all.
Irony!
Otherwise, no real past medical history. She was full term. Her vaccinations were all up to date.
This is obviously billed as an interesting case, so it probably wasn't just a virus. But it is just a virus 99% of the time. Saul, what stands out to you as this not being just bronchiolitis in the middle of bronchiolitis season, or not just some other virus?
Well, I don't have vital signs. Can we hear some vital signs?
Yeah, absolutely. The heart rate was, and this, I remember, is a 5-month-old. So the heart rate was 185. Blood pressure was 90 over 60. Respiratory rate was 48. Temperature was 99 degrees Fahrenheit. And the kid was sitting 100% on room air.
That's tachycardia out of proportion. That bothers me a little bit.
I was also thinking the other thing that kind of bugged me is the kid's been sick for 2 weeks, which is totally in the range of normal for bronchiolitis, but has only had a fever for a couple days, which is sort of a little bit weird. That fever seems to me to be something to think about, something that might be new.
With viruses, you typically see fevers early on, and this kid had fevers later on in the course. So I might be thinking, you know, could this kid have developed a pneumonia or something more sinister, especially with that tachycardia out of proportion? And I think a good rule of thumb is generally for every degree above normal, you know, your heart rate generally should go up about 7 to 10 beats. In this case, this kid only has a 99 temp, so technically is afebrile and is really tachycardic.
That last little bit may be the most important part of this segment in terms of identifying the kid who's really sick. Like Eileen said, in the middle of bronchiolitis season, 99% of the time, it's just a simple virus, and it's going to be fine, but a fever occurring late in the course of illness and tachycardia out of proportion to fever should prompt concern. Since most of us don't do a lot of pediatrics, it's hard to remember the normal vital sign ranges for kids, and we'll drop a table for that in the show notes. This patient's exam was fairly benign, except for maybe a slight increase in their respiratory rate. The lung exam was unremarkable, but a chest x-ray was obtained which showed no effusions, no vascular congestion, but there was some cardiomegaly. Given the tachycardia, the doc that was seeing the patient administered 2 fluid boluses.
The patient then developed worsening work of breathing, increased crackles, and had some color changes to the lips.
I think thinking about sepsis, thinking about dehydration when you see that tachycardia are both very reasonable. And a small fluid challenge is probably a reasonable thing to do. I think that's what I might have done next.
And it's funny, I think like once every other bronchiolitis season, you know, amongst the slew of snotty, wheezy, respiratory viral kids, there's always a case like this where you think the kid has just got a viral illness and then it turns out to be something bad.
So at this point, I think we need to kind of re-examine what our differential is. We have some evidence of tachycardia out of proportion in the setting of some viral symptoms. What are you guys worried about in this setting?
I'd be worried about heart failure. I'd be worried about some kind of underlying cardiopathology.
That seems cool. Another of the incredible pediatric faculty at County USC.
Yeah, I think I'd also be worried. Maybe this kid had pneumonia with effusions that, you know, is somewhat leaky. Maybe he's septic and something like that might be going on as well, or ARDS as well.
When the patient doesn't respond the way you expect to your intervention, in this case, fluids, you've got to take a step back and reanalyze the data in front of you. It's easy during the winter months to get early closure on kids who come in with respiratory symptoms, but slowing down, switching from system 1, your gestalt-based thinking, to incorporating a bit more of the system 2, slow methodical thinking is going to be really important. Based on the worsening respiratory status, James decided to take the airway using ketamine and atropine pretreatment, and a repeat chest x-ray afterwards showed pulmonary edema.
And I think ketamine's a fine choice for this. It'll, you know, release some extra catecholamines, which is probably good for cardiac output at this point.
The only thing that I would add to that is that with ketamine, it is a direct myocardial suppressant. So it sounds like this kid was just at the verge of decompensating and probably had some reserve. And I like the fact that they chose to intubate the child at that point. because had they waited and let the kid get into extremis prior to intubating, at that point, the child's intrinsic catecholamines may have been depleted, and you would really see the effect of that direct myocardial suppressant effect of ketamine. And those are the kids that crash during intubation. So I want to say I like the timing that they chose for the intubation, and I think the drug combination was reasonable given the timing.
Way back in October 2015, we discussed the role of atropine in intubation with Andy Sloss, and the bottom line was that the evidence behind using it was pretty suspect. It's unlikely that it's necessary to add this step.
So let's take a step back. 5-month-old who came in with what looked like, you know, your average viral syndrome, who then after getting what seemed like a reasonable fluid challenge, decompensated and went into respiratory distress and is now intubated. You've got, you know, a rather broad differential, and you've kind of now got to reassess what do you do at this point? What do you actually think that this patient has? What kind of workup do you think you need to do beyond the chest x-ray that you have? And what kind of steps do you want to take from here?
Dr. Kuhl notes that the x-ray shows cardiomegaly, significant cardiomegaly.
I really want to see an echocardiogram on this kid, even if it's just a bedside echo, just to kind of get an idea of like global function. Like, is this kid squeezing? Is this kid not squeezing? Is it big and floppy? Is it restricted and tight? Is there a big tamponade there? Is, you know, like what's going on in and around the heart?
Or even to take a step back and get more basic, maybe just an EKG. At 5 months, if you're going to go into heart failure, which I think we're all presuming might have been what tipped this child over, there's not a huge differential. Sure, you could have a late presenting congenital heart disease, but also I think we're thinking about things like viral myocarditis, which would go well with this protracted viral course eking into probably a cardiac event. I would think a little bit of something called Al-Kappa, which is an abnormality of the left main coronary artery that can predispose children to early MIs. So I'd love to have a look at that EKG and see that this kid didn't just have a STEMI. And obviously you would think of congenital stuff like VSDs that don't really count as congenital heart disease. Usually those present around 6 weeks, but you can be tipped over by an intercurrent viral illness. I think it's unlikely to have that without hearing a murmur. That having been said, sometimes you don't hear a murmur in a very large VSD. And honestly, when a kid is tachy at almost 190, I don't know that my cardiac exam is really worth anything.
In addition to the EKG and the bedside echo looking for B-lines, gross cardiac function, and a pericardial effusion, you're going to send a CBC, BNP, blood cultures, a venous gas with a lactate, and a troponin. Saul also recommends a TSH, as you can clearly get high output cardiac failure with severe hyperthyroidism.
So patient got a steady KG, which showed a fast, narrow, regular complex with P waves consistent with sinus tachycardia. Did have some questionable ST elevations in some of the precordial leads without any evidence of any reciprocal changes.
James, how fast was the heart rate?
160.
Okay, that's a pretty reasonable heart rate for a 5-month-old. If you happen to see this kid was like 230, 240, it's not changing with respirations. You know, SVT is not an uncommon cause of heart failure in little infants. So keep that in mind.
One of the problems with myocarditis is we say, well, 95% of these patients have an abnormal EKG, but we count sinus tach as an abnormal EKG finding. So a perfectly, completely normal EKG makes myocarditis unlikely. However, any positive finding, including sinus tach, unfortunately still keeps that on the differential.
The labs trickle back showing that the patient is anemic, has a small anion gap of 16, as well as a positive troponin around 2 and a markedly elevated BNP.
A echo was obtained, which showed a severely dilated LV with severely depressed LV contractility, had an EF of around 20%. They did note that there were normal proximal coronary arteries, again, addressing the concern for L-kappa. We did do a bedside ultrasound, again, trying to see if there was any kind of evidence for pericardial effusion, because that was what we were concerned. We did not see any tamponade at that point.
Based on everything to this point, the group is pretty confident in the diagnosis of myocarditis. Making a diagnosis is nice, and now it's a matter of what we need to do for this kid in front of us.
For frontline providers, what do you guys do? At this point, what would the management orders that you would write include?
I mean, depending on the perfusion of the kid and the blood pressure, I would consider starting some sort of inotropic support, whether that be in the form of maybe a low-dose dopamine or even milrinone to afterload reduce. I think those are pretty reasonable options if you're really concerned about the perfusion, especially if you have that echo report where you're having terrible, poor function.
What do you do about lines? Are you comfortable starting that peripherally?
I mean, I think you can certainly start with a peripheral IV. That's not a problem at all. But I think for this kid, as sick as they are, you're going to need to, you know, think about getting central access at some point, either ephemeral or an IJ.
I do think it's optimal to actually do a central line in these kids, especially when you're looking at possibly putting on multiple drips. But for the most part, if you do have the peripheral line, just start it in the peripheral line. I don't think there's anything to be faulted for putting in the peripheral line. It does take quite a bit of time to actually get a central line in such a small infant, especially when you're not versed at doing central lines in children that small to begin with.
And I think what you will be faulted for is delaying and then the kid crumps because you waited too long. That's not ideal.
And peripheral pressors are something that we're starting to hear about in adults. Obviously, they came from pediatrics because adults really are just big kids. Billy Mallon, if you're listening. But I think that the same principles apply as they do in the adult population. If you have a very tenuous 24 gauge that may be somewhat infiltrated in the hand, that's probably not something that you're going to put dopamine or epinephrine through. If that's all you can get, maybe an IO until you can get a central line.
The key is to start vasoactive support and not to delay. IO is going to be my choice since I haven't done a CVL in a pediatric patient in years. If the patient's BP is good, Eileen says you can go with dobutamine, lots of beta agonism, which will improve cardiac function and peripherally vasodilate, making it easier for the heart to work. Most of us were taught to start with dobutamine at 5 mics per kilo per minute, but you can push this dose higher to get more inotropy. If the pressure's soft or you're worried about hypotension developing, epinephrine may be a better choice, and you can start anywhere from 0.1 to 0.5 mics per kilo per minute and then titrate up. Milrinone is often preferred by pediatric intensivists, but it's rarely used in the ED. This drug needs to be loaded 50 to 70 mics per kilo over about 20 minutes, and then a drip can be started around 0.75 mics per kilo per minute, but it'd be reasonable to ask your intensivist to give a little bit of help with this since, let's be honest, we don't reach for this drug very often.
So she was started on Milrinone drip and then also started on a Lasix drip, which is also recommended, giving them both a bolus and then starting them on a drip.
I think the fluids in these kids is one of the trickiest things to manage because you want to make sure they're perfusing and having enough in the tank to, you know, get that blood to the organs. But at the same time, their heart is so underperforming that you can easily fluid overload them.
It's a really tight balance between maintaining filling the tank and then also actually decreasing the load on the heart.
But realistically, this child had a systolic blood pressure of 90, and 70 for a systolic blood pressure for a child under the age of 1 year is reasonable.
Yeah,
so I think the kid had a little room to move on the blood pressure.
To this point, our focus has been on identification and resuscitation, but thinking about the causes of myocarditis are important as well. Most cases are caused by any of a slew of viruses, including HHV6, enteroviruses, and parvoviruses. Not much we can do about any of those, but James cautions us to think about the causes that we can treat.
Worldwide, the most common cause of myocarditis is actually protozoal. It's Chagas, which we actually see more and more in the United States than previously thought. So we get about 300,000 Chagas infections in the U.S., and that's mostly in adults. But actually now they're finding congenital Chagas. So you get about 300 cases of congenital Chagas in the U.S. births per year.
How does that work with congenital? Like, what?
So
does the fly get up in there? And
it's unclear to me exactly what Saul meant by all up in there. So we're going to plan a separate upcoming session with him so we can dive deeper into this topic. What about some other causes to think about?
So if Kawasaki's is the cause of your myocarditis, IVIG is useful, probably not so much in other conditions. Immunosuppressants, steroids and other immunosuppressants are kind of controversial. There are some big studies showing no difference in outcomes. But then, as always, a few pediatric case reports and small series pop in there that do show potentially improved outcomes.
There has been a Cochrane review that was done in 2013 that showed that steroids does not reduce mortality in the case of viral myocarditis. There's questionable change in whether or not it affects the LV ejection fraction, but really right now the recommendations are not to give the steroids, especially if you think that the patient is in the acute phase of myocarditis because of the fact that the acute phase is associated with a high viral load, and then you're giving, you know, immunosuppressive agents, you can actually end up worsening their status. When it comes to IVIG right now, the recommendations are no. There was also a Cochrane review with this, again showing that there is no mortality benefit. And this one also showed that there was no difference in LV ejection fraction either.
One of the scary complications of this in my mind is these weird dysrhythmias that they can undergo because their heart's all stretched and their electrical system is all stretched out and messed up, and they can get really, really life-threatening dysrhythmias. So I think that's something it's important to point out.
For pulseless VTAC and VFib, that's going to be shocks initially at 2 joules per kilo, followed by 4 joules per kilo. For medications, epinephrine, 0.01 milligrams per kilo, and if needed, amiodarone at a dose of 5 milligrams per kilo.
Let's start wrapping this resuscitation up since the other 100 patients with URIs are stacking up. What's our disposition plan?
The recommendations right now is once you've made the diagnosis, obviously, our patient was intubated and sedated, so that's relatively obvious where she's going. But even if the patient is well appearing, the disposition for all these patients is going to be the PICU for exactly the reasons that we mentioned, right, that these patients are prone for dysrhythmias. They are prone for relatively rapid decompensation, so they need to be admitted to a monitored setting. And if you're in an outside hospital, if you're in a community setting that doesn't have a PICU, they need to be sent to a hospital that has the potential for either ECMO or cardiac transplant, because these patients can get very sick very quickly.
Summary.
So one of the pearls that I really picked up out of this case was the importance of the tachycardia out of proportion. You know, I primarily see adults. I'm an emergency physician. I don't specialize in kids. And so when I see the vital signs of kids, I see tachycardia and I'm like, oh, kids are always tachycardic. Okay. But getting an idea of what is tachycardia out of proportion, you know, we hear about pain out of proportion in the setting of different disease processes or poop, right? Pain out of proportion. Well, now what I've come to kind of think about is tachycardia out of proportion or TOOP, right? That's one of the things that now is like sticking in the back of my mind when I'm briefly looking at these vital signs in a kid who's probably just a viral syndrome. That's now the new kind of mnemonic that I'm now keeping in the back of my mind. That's going to hopefully send some alarm bells going and make me think that maybe this isn't just a case of the sniffles.
Well, thank you, James. This is an interesting case that I think brings up a lot of the really relevant points of myocarditis. It can be a subtle presentation early on, and over half of these cases are missed on their initial contact with healthcare. And part of that is the subtlety of the case. Part of that is us taking a step back and looking at some of the high yield features that might make us think about this being the one myocarditis patient in a sea of uncomplicated viral syndromes. Hepatomegaly is a good finding on exam. Tachycardia out of proportion, tachycardia that's not resolving with resolution of the fever, murmurs if you have them. An EKG is going to be positive for something most of the time. Don't over-rely on the chest x-ray. Usually you will get a chest x-ray finding like this. Well, maybe a little bit of cardiomegaly. In truth, only about 40% of chest x-rays of myocarditis patients do show cardiomegaly, and only about 60% are abnormal. So don't be falsely reassured. Send the appropriate studies, know the limitations and the sensitivity, and most importantly, trust your gut. If something isn't quite adding up right to a viral syndrome, just take a step back, maybe give a fluid challenge, and reassess the patient and see if they're developing any of these signs that are tipping you off that it may be a more complicated viral syndrome than everybody else.